From WBEZ Chicago, I'm Natalie Moore, and this is Making Stories Without End. Here, I take you on a journey to learn about daytime soap operas and their broad reach on television. Many people don't know that the serial started right here in Chicago. Join me as we talk about the social impact, history, and lasting legacy of television's unique, immersive storytelling. Soaps and women, what do you think about? Probably catfights.
I don't want him anymore. How do you think you are? Giving me my husband back to me?
That's exactly what you want.
John and I shared more love, more life than
you. Really, Barbara, I gotta tell you, you gotta screw loose.
I take it very personally when my husband tries to pull a fast one to suit the whims of some peroxide tramp who has made it a veritable career of screwing up everybody else's
stop
life.
Stop it, would ya?
You have made a career, a life's work out of hurting other people. Any resemblance between you and a human being is purely accidental. You are an evil, vicious monster sealed inside the shell of an aging whore.
That's for Bridget.
Stephanie!
That's for Hope. And get the hell out of here. I'm telling you, your daughter is never going to be around you again.
The morally ambiguous woman character is an important figure in the history of daytime serials. Think the bitch goddess, the vixen. You know who created that archetype? Erna Phillips, the founder of soaps, who we learned about in the first episode. Soap operas may be written off as a low-regarded, feminized art form. Nah, I don't buy that. For decades, soaps routinely pushed serious social issues the general public didn't even know about because they weren't paying attention to soaps. Women are at the crux. Abortion, cancer, rape. And FYI, I want to warn you about the content. We're going to talk a lot about rape later in the episode. And we'll discuss the writing torch that Erna Phillips passed to her two protégés in Chicago. Erna Phillips was on a roll. After success with radio serials and The Guiding Light transitioning to TV, she created As the World Turns in 1956. In the early days, Phillips penned a story about a central couple and an extramarital affair. Soap scholar Elena Levine loves what the storyline represented. She is the author of Her Stories, Daytime Soap Opera in U.S. Television History.
My favorite example of this is in the early years of As the World Turns, which Phillips created for television in 1956. And she told a story in the early days of that soap about an extramarital affair. Basically, one of the central couples of the show, the man was having an affair with another woman. And there's a great story about how Phillips wanted to, you know, have this marriage break up and see what would happen. And Procter & Gamble was very reluctant to represent anything that seemed to make it seem as if divorce was a good thing for anybody. They, you know, were a very traditional company and wanted to uphold very traditional values. And so they wouldn't let her basically tell a story where the man leaves his wife, marries his mistress, and lives happily ever after. So decades later, she was talking about this, and she remarks that, well, she just decided to just kill him.
Phillips wouldn't be daunted by rules.
It's one of the great things about soap opera, right, is that they're this, you know, very mainstream form whose function is really there to sell household products to women in the home, and yet they have all these somewhat potentially subversive elements because they can't have just nothing happen. They need the conflict, and so they can make all this interesting stuff happen.
Mind you, this is the post-World War II era of white middle-class America. Notions of domesticity, marriage, and suburban consumerism are being considered and challenged. Phillips provided a platform, yet she was also conflicted. In her unpublished autobiography, Phillips muses that maybe she made a serious mistake in writing stories about strong women for too long. the climbing divorce rate of the 1950s alarmed her, and she wondered if the dominant women in daytime serials had some influence on her female audience. At any rate, Phillips never shifted course. I would say she doubled down. She co-created Another World in 1964. In soaps, production costs were low, profits were up, the networks were happy. Soaps expanded to black and white television and transitioned out of radio serials by the 1960s. Among her innovations on the small screen was the vixen, the diva. You know her, you see her. Think every fierce, sexy woman character you've seen on TV. Any Shonda Rhimes protagonist. You pretty much have Phillips to thank for that. The first was Lisa on As the World Turns. Lisa had multiple affairs, not to mention multiple marriages, engaged in bribery, and attempted a fake suicide. Here's Lisa in 1962 talking to her husband, Bob, asserting her agency as women on soaps have long done.
Having another child would be the best thing that could happen to us right now. Well?
No, Bob.
When I said the best thing that could happen to us, I meant for our marriage.
I know what you meant.
Knowing how much Tom means to you, it's the most natural thing in the world for you to want another child. You must have a very good reason not to.
But, Bob, I don't want to talk about it. Not now.
Not now, Lisa. When?
Well, I don't know. One of these days soon.
Well, then you do agree that we do have something to talk over.
Yes.
Because, Lisa, I am not happy the way our marriage is right now. You might as well know that.
Well, I am not happy the way things are either, Bob. And as I said, I'll talk to you about it till some other day.
The world's biggest and brightest vixen was Erica Kane of All My Children.
Why would you let him so wild oats with this witch? Shut up, I am speaking.
Mercurial and vain, beautiful and conniving.
You said the word quarry twice. You told Jack and the gang where you are, just like I thought you would. You set me up. I know you, remember?
Susan Lucci originated the role in 1970 when the soap premiered. But she hadn't won a daytime Emmy for Best Lead Actress. This was considered a huge travesty. Lucci was constantly overlooked for her work, and her losing streak became legendary. In 1999, I went to my friend Candace's apartment on a Friday night to watch the Emmys. I was a grad student studying journalism at Northwestern. She was a grad student at the University of Chicago studying art history. One of the sharpest intellectuals I know, Candace is a bigger soap fan than me.
Even if you didn't like Erica, you were attracted to her. There was just something about that character and like the things she did. And even when Erica was at her worst, you still root for her. It sounds trite, but she is Erica Kane. Like there's not another way to really describe it.
So that Friday night over at Takeout and Wine, we expected Susan Lucci to lose for the 19th time.
And the outstanding diva is... The streak is over, Susan Lucci!
The audience cried. Candace and I cried. Oprah cheered from the wings of the stage.
You changed the face of the medium we work in. I am so grateful to have been placed in your hands. Thank you so much for creating the part of Erica Kane and for allowing me to be part of your writing full of such humanity and passion and vision.
Agnes Nixon is the name to remember. She created All My Children and before that, One Life to Live. Nixon attended Northwestern University where she studied drama and wrote radio plays. Her father lived in Chicago. He wasn't exactly encouraging of his daughter's writing career, but nonetheless helped arrange a meeting with Erna Phillips. And that's how she ended up working for the Queen of Soaps. If Phillips created the foundation for soaps, Nixon pushed the envelope. Phillips hired her as head writer of The Guiding Light. Nixon wanted to do a cancer storyline about how uterine cancer is curable if caught in time. She suggested it to CBS and Procter & Gamble, which owned the soap. They said no, at first. They gave the green light, but with caveats. Don't say cancer, uterus, or hysterectomy. The year? 1962.
Literally.
When do you go to the hospital?
Oh, tomorrow or the next day. They'll let me know when a room is available.
Dad said you might have to have surgery.
The character, Bert Bauer, hadn't been to the doctor in 12 years. Like a lot of women back then, she didn't go to the doctor after the birth of her last child. She got a pap smear and learned of irregular cells. Remember, the word cancer was banned from the show. Despite the restrictions, the storyline was a game changer in soaps. Nixon's own doctor told her that many women came in for pap tests because of Bert Bauer. Here is a fan letter from a San Diego woman I found in Nixon's archives.
Dear cast, crew, writers, etc., a few months ago on your TV program, The Guiding Light, you tried, I'm sure, to put a point across to the audience, namely that all women should have a cancer checkup regularly. I had heard this before, of course, but because of an almost daily reminder, I did go and have a checkup. My condition is similar to that of Bert Bauer, so thanks to your program, you may have literally saved my life. May 10th, 1962.
Okay, I want to talk to you about abortion. When people think about abortion and groundbreaking television depictions, this sitcom is lauded.
I think it would be wrong to have a child at our age.
Oh, so do I, Walter. Oh, Walter, so do I.
We'd make awful parents.
Oh, impatient, irascible.
Awful. It's just not our time
of life. For other people, it might be fine, but for us, I don't think it would be fair to anybody. Oh, Walter, hold me close.
That's Bea Arthur, playing Maude on the television show of the same name. 47 years old and pregnant in 1972. She had an abortion. Sure, important to the discourse, and I don't want to minimize the cultural impact, but I think the reason people only evoke Maude around abortion is because it was on during primetime, and legendary producer Norman Lear developed the sitcom, a spinoff of All in the Family. The real props should go to All My Children. I'll let soap historian Elena Levine explain.
Erica Kane on All My Children is pretty widely known and remarked upon to be the first legal abortion on American television, because a lot of people think that the character had the abortion after the Roe versus Wade decision.
Turns out it was a few years before that. Levine actually figured it out herself while researching her book. Videos of these old episodes can be really hard to find, so she was digging through old scripts.
And was getting very frustrated when I was looking through 1973 and could not find this story. And started going back in time and found it in the 1971 scripts. So this happened before Roe, when there were differing abortion laws in different states across the country, much like in the present day.
Beyond YouTube, it's difficult to access soap opera archives. Even the networks would tape over episodes. Remember, these were 30-minute or one-hour shows on every single weekday. No reruns. Like Levine, I was able to get my hands on part of the All My Children script.
She finds herself pregnant, does not want to be a mother, does not want to have a child. Is very explicit about that. Has many, many conversations with many characters about this. I don't want to be a mother. This isn't right for me. I wouldn't be a good mother. All pretty good arguments, pretty legitimate claims for why she thinks that she should terminate this pregnancy. And because of the differing abortion laws in different states at the time, Erica has to kind of go through a bit of a journey to figure out how to make this happen for herself. She lived in, the fictional character lived in a fictional town in Pennsylvania where there was access to legal abortion, but it required permission of your husband. So she doesn't want to deal with that. She doesn't want her husband to know at first. She goes to New York to try to get an abortion. The wait is too long. I just think that's such an interesting detail of the story. That was just this very subtle way of commenting on the fact that, to have access to this procedure is out of reach, even if you can get to a place where it's legal. And then she ends up back in Pennsylvania and ultimately just lies to the doctor and kind of fakes her husband's approval in various ways.
In 1971, Nixon wanted to bring abortion to the fictional town of Pine Valley. She wrote in her autobiography that the audience reaction to the storyline was divided. Pro-choice groups criticized All My Children for having the wrong person have an abortion. Erica was not considered a good enough character. Nixon wrote they thought the kind of woman needed to promote the choice option was admirable and unimpeachable. So in other words, not a vixen. Nixon was Catholic and pro-choice. Her view was that illegal abortions endangered women's lives. Her fellow Catholics criticized her too. Nixon didn't mind. She wrote that meant the show was helping people voice their opinions. I knew about Erica Kane and abortion, but researching this podcast led me to learn that in 1964, Erna Phillips wrote an abortion story on Another World. A young woman named Pat got pregnant, and her boyfriend Tom convinced her to have an abortion, which was an illegal abortion. She does. She doesn't tell her family. She doesn't tell anybody that she's pregnant. And she gets sick and contracts an infection as a result of this illegal abortion. The infection was not about punishment, but once again, an example of Phillips opening the door to start thinking about an issue like abortion in different ways. After the break, we hear about Erna Phillips' second protege, a Chicago man who turned soap operas into a platform for the sexual revolution.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025.
Sex and soaps and women's desire in the bedroom. Let's go back to the 1960s. There was a campy soap called Dark Shadows with a supernatural element. And multiple women had deep lust for the vampire.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, if it weren't for the clothes, well, forgive me for staring, but for the moment it seems as though I'd seen a
ghost.
Soaps are about romance, after all. But then, William J. Bell came along. This is Brad Bell, Bill's son. He's still working in the business.
He answered basically an ad in the paper to try out to be a writer for soap operas. It turned out that, you know, that was by Procter & Gamble. And you know, the person looking for a writer was Erna Phillips, the godmother of all soaps.
He wanted to make himself completely invaluable to her. And he did.
So it was television, but he grew up listening to radio soaps, and then a lot of those soaps made the transition, like Guiding Light and As the World Turns, which were two that he worked on, Another World he co-created in their early days. But it was all Procter & Gamble. It was all based out of the Midwest and shot in New York. Erna didn't like to fly, and he would get on the train with her. She would go all night. She wasn't a big sleeper or a flyer. And she was a big worker, and he would just, whatever she would, stories that she would come up with, he would be there with the typewriter, pounding it down, and they developed a great relationship.
The writing took place in Chicago, intriguing young Brad.
And I would just sit under the table, you know, as a kid and listen, for hours. And I would be totally engaged. And, you know, they were all chain smoking and kind of raucous and, you know, throwing things out there. And I was just fascinated because growing up in Chicago, there wasn't a lot of this. So I think, I felt like I was in a very special place and that at some point maybe I could get into this mysterious business of Hollywood production.
Bill Bell was married to a local celebrity, Lee Phillip. Phillip, not Phillips, so no relation to Erna, hosted a daily talk show for more than 30 years. She was the Chicago queen of daytime.
The Lee Phillip Show, brought to you by Tidy House. Lee's special guests, songstress Connie Boswell and Dr. Willis J. Potts. And now here's Lee.
Connie Boswell has
She was known for her charm and grace. As a school child, my mother watched her talk show when she came home for lunch in elementary school. In 1973, the Bells created The Young and the Restless. That show is still on today, and even if you don't watch soaps, that piano theme must be familiar to you. Soap historian Andrew Wyatt loves to compare how Erna Phillips' proteges tell stories. He says Bell tapped into internal psychological issues with his characters and...
Bill brought in glitz and glamour. He understood the importance of people looking pretty as a hook because he wanted to write very slow burn stories.
My father's legacy, you know, he wouldn't mind hearing that. But that was a component of it, you know, and not the component that he was maybe would like to be known for first and foremost. But he loved, and that was a time when soaps were really pushing the envelope with sexuality and getting into the intimacies of a marriage or an affair or, you know, even a mother-daughter, you know, interfamily relationships. But yeah, he wanted Young and Restless to be sexy when it came out.
Brad Bell says his father wanted music to be scored beautifully, relying on production values and lighting as key components. Erna Phillips had her proteges, and her proteges had proteges. One of them is Kay Alden. She joined the Young and the Restless writing team as a 20-something-year-old and describes her pathway to soap writing.
Well, it is a saga.
She was writing her dissertation on soaps in 1973 and put Bill Bell high on her interview list.
I looked it up in the phone book. There was a number listed for William J. Bell on Lakeshore Drive. So I called him up blind, no preparation, nothing. Told him who he answers his own phone, by the way, always did, never had a secretary. So he answered, and I told him who I was and what I was doing, and I would it be possible for me to come interview him. For some reason, he agreed to this. What I did not know at the time was that in his entire life prior to this time, William J. Bell had never had a positive encounter with an academic. He would agree to interviews and then they would come and just diss him. And, you know, like, you write this dribble, just nasty, nasty stuff.
They talked for hours. Alden felt she had to shoot her shot and she pitched that she wanted to write for him. Bell gave her an assignment to write a sample script. Less than 6 months later, he hired her for Young and the Restless. Alden dropped out of her PhD program and spent 40 years writing for his soaps, much of the time under Bell's direct tutelage. After the break, Kay Alden tells me about a pioneering rape storyline on Young and the Restless.
Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
In the mid-1970s, The Young and the Restless took on rape. Kay Alden walks us through what happened.
I'm trying to think how old Chris would have been at this time. Maybe 20. I don't think she would have been 21 yet in the character, I mean. And she went on a date with this very clean-cut guy. When he brought her home from the date, when she tried to close the door, his foot was stuck in the door.
The rape was not shown, but the foot in the door expressed enough. William Bell wrote The Young and the Restless, YNR for short, but his wife Lee had a tremendous influence as co-founder of the soap. She had won a local and national Emmy in 1973 for a documentary on rape. The YNR character of Chris not only had to deal with the trauma of rape, but explaining how the guy Curtis raped her. Classic victim blaming, reflective of the times. YNR poked at that.
They did manage to bring in a woman officer who was a little more sensitive, but there was no, you know, I mean, George Curtis, he's a very ordinary, nice guy, dresses nice, clean cut. What do you mean he raped you? How did you lead him on? You know, you let him into your apartment, right? No, he stuck his foot in the door. Well, come on. It was a brutally realistic story of a rape. The impact of that rape carried on for years in the storyline because it messed her up emotionally.
Society began grappling with rape in the 1970s with the visibility of the rape crisis movement. The public had a long way to go in understanding rape, because rape was seen as an act committed by a stranger in a dark alley.
One thing that happens in date rape scenarios is that women, because of the way that our culture has treated this kind of a situation, women, maybe less now, I hope less now, but women tend to blame themselves, like, what did I do? How did I lead him on? And in the stories that we told, the police are asking those same questions. Well, what did you do? You know, I mean, how did you cause this to happen to you? So one thing that we wanted to address was that way of thinking. Like, the rape victim is not the causative factor here. Also, I think we wanted to make a statement about the whole type of conversations that surround rape among law enforcement, among police officers.
The second wave of feminism was in full effect in this country. Soap historian Elena Levine gives kudos to YNR and the character Chris.
They told a story that was very engaged with kind of the anti-rape movement of the era, which was both a feminist effort and a broader kind of criminal justice kind of effort in the 70s. And she goes through all of the experiences of victims not being believed, being, you know, interrogated on the stand in a trial, you know, all of this kind of stuff that was very shocking to see because the mainstream media hadn't really told stories about this before this point. And her story, that story of Chris Brooks, is really one of those, you know, kind of early moments where soaps were able to deal with this question in a way that had a broader kind of social and political significance to it. Before that, they told rape stories that had personal significance, right? And you would see how the woman typically in these stories suffered and was harmed, but it didn't have the same level of sort of social and political import. And in a broader social context where things like the women's liberation movement and other forms of anti-rape activism were being very overt in talking about rape and its role in the justice system, stories like that really made an impact.
Now imagine breaking the silence around marital rape in the 1970s, a term hardly anyone used. States didn't even view it as an actual crime. Guiding Light challenged its audience in 1979. Agnes Nixon was heading her own shows and was no longer the head writer. In a very uncomfortable scene, the character Roger questions his wife Holly about her alleged affair. He gets violent, they struggle, and he throws her on the couch.
Now you just understand, let's get something straight. I'm your husband, I have certain rights here. You know, if I were Ed, you wouldn't be in such a hurry to leave.
Roger is a menace. He follows Holly around the living room. He blocks her from leaving.
Gina.
He throws her on the bed. The scene fades. The implication is clear.
No, please don't.
Holly doesn't stay quiet about the rape and seeks help and guidance at the hospital. viewers see up close that marital rape is a real thing. I really struggled whether to include General Hospital's Luke and Laura in this episode. They were a cultural phenomenon that transcended soap fans and into the broader mainstream. 30 million viewers tuned in to their 1981 televised wedding. In a cameo, Elizabeth Taylor, a fan of the show, played a villain who cursed the super couple. 2 years earlier, Luke and Laura worked at the campus disco. They were friendly toward each other. Luke was a two-bit hustler and thinks he's gonna die because of his crimes. One night, he is drunk and wants to dance with her.
Dance with her.
No.
I said, dance with me.
Laura rebuffs him. Luke rapes her on the dance floor. The storyline doesn't end there. Laura talks about her rape and goes to a rape support group. Her feelings are validated. She gradually talks to Luke, who feels awful about what he's done. I'll let Elena Levine pick it up from here.
Through a series of events, they kind of become more and more connected to each other and end up taking off and going on the run together to escape some bad guy. And kind of it's after they take off and are together running away that they eventually fall in love, and they kind of entirely stop talking about the rape and become just sort of this, just becomes a story of a young couple in love, falling in love. And the rape doesn't kind of gets buried from there and doesn't get mentioned really until the 90s when they do deal with it in some really interesting ways.
Say it.
Lucky dog.
Say it!
You think that's going to make you feel better? I promise you it won't.
I want to hear the words. If you can't look me in the eye and tell me the truth, man, that we have nothing. We have less than nothing.
Less than nothing? Is that so? All right. A long time ago, long before you were born, in another life, I raped your mother.
That's Lucky, Luke and Laura's son, in 1998. Lucky confronts his father. Then he goes to his mother.
The campus disco. How did that come
up? Because it's where he raped you. Is that when you fell in love with him? Because you told me it was love at first sight. So what did you mean? Did you mean that when the song was playing, the lights were going, he had you pinned down?
I don't deserve to be ambushed.
I heard it too many times, you know? No, I know. I'm too young, right? I'm too simple-minded. You were teased, Dad was a drunk, right? And he thought he was gonna die.
Stop it, please, stop!
Lucky is devastated. Meanwhile, he's been helping his friend Elizabeth heal from her rape. Lucky finds out about his parents and feels betrayed. Okay, I didn't want to originally bring up the Luke and Laura rape because I thought it had been discussed enough. The actress who played Laura, Jeannie Francis, is over being interviewed about it. I was talking about this to my producer, Hina, who is 25 years old and not a soap fan. She was amazed the rape storyline resurfaced with the son 2 decades later. She had never seen anything like that before on television. That's the uniqueness of soaps. By nature of the form being decades long, by nature of the characters being so intensely developed, redeemed, and punished over and over again, you are able to tell a really nuanced story of rape. Maybe the most nuanced story you will ever find. Because Laura's story of the victim is spelled out and told, and then Luke can be redeemed decades later, and his actions can still remain hurtful. It's tricky to say something was the first on television. But non-soap depictions of abortion and rape on TV back in the day did not provide nuance, much less a female perspective.
The main male characters, the lawyers or the doctors, would be the ones who would be struggling with the issue, would be trying to figure out what's the right thing to do here. And it was really a story about them and their moral judgment. The women characters were not really at the center of those narratives at all.
From the beginning, Erna Phillips ensured women would be at the center. Women really like soaps, but there is a very specific group of women who love soaps. In fact, they over-index on it. And they're women a lot like me. Next episode, Black Representation on Soaps. That's coming up on Stories Without End. Stories Without End is a production of WBEZ Chicago and part of the NPR network. I'm your host and writer, Natalie Moore. The show was produced by Hina Srivastava and edited by Ariel Van Cleve. It's mixed by Haley Bloomquist. We had music and production assistance from Justin Bull and Dave Mista. Thanks to Brendan Banizak. Our executive producer is Tracy Brown.